This is the Grainian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grainian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, on the internet. It is the Grainian Report, broadcasting through our home in cyberspace, the KGRA Radio Network. That's KGRARadio.com. Wonderful of all you fine folks out there joining us in the chat room, joining us on Twitter, via the live streams. Matter of fact, actually, probably Live 365 app on your phone. If you don't know this already, you can stream this program from a smartphone device with the Live 365 app. All you gotta do is search for KGRA on there and click play. Easy as that. Cheap and dirty streaming internet. Love it. Follow me on Twitter, Micah Hanks on Twitter. Yes, I have my own name, and you can email me at any time, info@MicahHanks.com. Do be sure and check out Grainian X, by the way, our subscriber program. Got some really great stuff for subscribers. Just today, yeah, this shows you how busy I've been. Just today, we posted a all-new episode of Grainian Enigmas, looking at one of my favorite all-time classic UFO cases. Do check that out. And yes, the Grainian X podcast with an archival interview. One that has never aired before. No Grainian listener has... Well, I wouldn't say no Grainian listener has ever heard this, but this is an interview from back in 2010 I didn't even realize still existed. And the reason I chose to bring this interview out of hiding is because it is an interview, the only full-length interview that I ever did on a radio program with Stanton Friedman. And people are always asking, why haven't you ever interviewed Stanton? Well, I have. And in advance of the Big Bear Lake conference I'm going to be at this weekend, Stanton's going to be there. And I thought it'd be very interesting to, in addition to some other colorful commentary, we would revisit this interview with Stanton. Really interesting to look back 6 years ago and see how much my ideas and attitudes have changed over time. Now, as we were talking in this last segment, a lot more than just ideas and attitudes may be changing here, in, if not the near future, at very least in the coming decades. And whether or not your mind is made up, one way that one can inform oneself and possibly change one's perspective is to reach out to the minds and the attitudes of others. And so tonight I'm very pleased to have a panel of individuals who I said I wanted to get back on the program in this configuration, but we've added another just to make things even more fun tonight. So we'll begin with our newcomer, a gentleman I could not believe it's been a year since I've spoken with this fellow, but Soraya of Where Did the Road Go?
How you doing, Micah?
Man, it's just, it's incredible that it's been so long since we last talked, but you're like me. You're producing how many shows a week now? Two, three?
Generally two.
Yeah. Staying busy, though. And I always get emails from people saying, you know, you ought to check out this episode. I heard this guy first on Where Did the Road Go? And that's the question I have for you, Soraya. Did you ever figure it out? Where did the road go?
Hopefully always to places we don't know.
That is generally what we always hope for. So, anyway, my dear friend, always good to hear your voice. Glad to have you back on and back in the pocket. Also joining us tonight, of course, one of the mischief masters, one of the true lords of mayhem, one of those trickster archetypes in and of himself, Mr. Red Pill Junkie, live from Mexico City. How are you, sir?
Hey, ¿qué pasa, guy? Glad to be back here at the Grainian Report with you guys.
Well, I've always said that even back when I had a couple of co-hosts, there was the unofficial other guy. And although you're not here every week, you're certainly one of those people who is integral to what we do on this program and, you know, working behind the scenes at all times and from all kinds of places. In fact,
yeah,
I think...
the guy who didn't get paid, always like...
No, I know.
It's always the case with Mexicans.
I need to... Well, you know, I'll tell you, I need to increase your wages. I really do. We'll talk about that. At very least, I know in April I'm going to be buying you a drink when I see you at the Paramania thing down there in Texas. But I've said too much already. Another guy I plan to see down there in Texas in early April is Mr. Joshua Cutchin, who is joining us here just as well. Yes. How are you doing there, sir?
Doing swimmingly. It's Mardi Gras season, so it's a busy time for a tuba player, but doing all right.
Yes. Well, I guess it is kind of a busy time. Last time Josh actually got up here to Asheville, he and I met at a place called, it's East Village Grill, which is over on my end of town. And he was coming right by it on his way up the mountain, and he was coming into town, into Asheville, to play a one-off, a show with a guy. And yes, that's what Josh does. He's the traveling tuba player. In fact, your icon there on Skype is you playing the tuba.
Yeah, I changed that a little while back. I felt might as well, you know. It's always a conversation starter with the UFO people. It's like, what's this tuba thing? And with the tuba people, it's like, what's this UFO thing? So I'm interesting anywhere I go, I guess.
Look. Now, that's the story of my life, as Soraya well knows, because it's this weird breakdown. I say Soraya because you always have played my songs and stuff when I've come on the show with you.
I have even played your songs when you weren't on the show.
Well, yes, indeed. And you said a lot of good music this way, including Psyche Corporation. May get a little of that in here later. You know, Psyche and I have actually had some very interesting correspondences over the last few months just as well. But anyway, and that's one thing I like about her music just as well, is that once again, there's a little of this kind of a post-human blues kind of an element to that just as well. So I thought that we would kick off this hour of the discussion discussing that very topic, what we just came off of the heels of. Transhumanism, singularity, artificial intelligence. These are, I think, at some point in our future, should we live long enough to see the advent of such things, they are inevitable. But are they necessarily good? Red Pill, I'd like to start with you. When we're talking about transhumanism, I remember speaking with a journalist on this program some time ago who referred to Ray Kurzweil's transhumanism and singularity as being blood-wrenchingly cold, and he was absolutely against it. I would ask you, do you feel the same, or do you see the bright side, the utopian element that transhuman theorists would hope for?
I'm not sure where exactly I stand with the whole transhumanist movement, because on the one hand, I clearly notice that it is driven by a purely materialistic view of the world and also of how human consciousness originates, right? They fairly stand on the assumption that human consciousness is generated by the brain solely, and with the death of the biological brain, consciousness ceases to exist. You know, it extinguishes and it, you know, it dissolves into the ether, as it were. So that is one of the things that I'm really not on pair with the whole thing of transhumanism. Also, the fact that it's clear that the reason why we're speaking about transhumanism, it has become such an en vogue topic lately, is because very powerful people, you know, all these dot-com billionaires who are 30-something years old and who are starting to think about their own mortality, and they probably think that transhumanism is a way out, is a way to achieve immortality and to live forever, happily ever after, you know, enjoying their billions of dollars, you know, or until the sun dies out or something. And that is also something that sits well with me. But on the other hand, I've become much more open to the idea that perhaps you could develop or design some kind of artificial brain that could be complex enough, so advanced enough that maybe, and there's a big maybe, consciousness could arise into it the same way that consciousness arises into our own biological brains. So what is this? The spin I'm using here is that I suspect that consciousness permeates the entirety of the universe, and maybe there could be a way in which consciousness could inhabit or could be tuned in by a synthetic brain, the same way that somehow it arises or manifests into a biological one.
Yeah, many of the very same things that you've discussed right there, I've certainly given consideration to. Now, I'll say this. You know, Red, you come at this very much from kind of a spiritual perspective, and in the last segment when we were discussing this story in the Daily Mail that I featured in the Graylian News today, I have often wondered if there would not be at times certain spiritual kinds of concepts that we wouldn't see mirrored in transhumanism, but just as much as spirituality. I know, Soraya, you have an interest in magic, and frankly, actually, my interest in magic and the occult, in terms of the history of magic and the occult, I certainly share that. I'm fascinated with that. But, you know, with your interest in that subject, would you perceive certain transhuman realities as being comparable to what we call magic? Or do you draw a distinct difference? I mean, is that much as Red Pill would say, the materialistic version versus the spiritualistic outlook on life, nature, and the cosmos?
I mean, magic's sort of a, I think, more of a subconscious thing rather than a technological thing. I mean, we could certainly have, and we've seen it in sci-fi ideas where you have like techno mages and things like that, where we have transhuman type of things that seem like we're doing magic because they're just technology manipulating the world around us. And really with the transhumanism thing, I stand pretty much right where Red Pill Junkie does for the most part. I always wonder when you see things like transporters in Star Trek, we don't understand consciousness, and it just takes for granted that if we recreate the same person on the other side, that the consciousness will go with it.
Yeah.
Maybe we can make a transporter, but who knows if it's going to be the exact same person on the other side.
You know, that's an interesting point that you bring up there. I've actually wondered that myself. Again, the question being, if you break down the physical nature of an individual, and we send them through space and time, and we reassemble them particle for particle in another location. In other words, we're talking about teleportation as Charles Fort, I think, who coined the term, and as many others who have used it since would envision the idea. And some have asked that question. You know, you break yourself down and reassemble yourself. Are you really you? Are you the same individual? Is the soul broken down and carried just as well? How does the soul or any part existing apart from your physical body recognize the disassembly and then the reassembly of your physical structure? And thus, is teleportation, if not possible, can it exist along with our conscious or ideas of consciousness and a soul? I mean, Joshua Cutchin, where would you stand on this?
Well, as long as there's not a fly in the teleporter pod, I think we're going to do okay.
Yeah, right?
A little Grundle fly action. You know, I feel like there would have to be some sort of, I'm much, very much in line with Soraya and RPJ, thinking that consciousness is something separate and discrete that probably would continue. I mean, the stat that you always hear is that, isn't it every 7 years that your body completely, sheds itself of its old cells and develops new cells? And this is a lot of things that some people in the consciousness community have always said. It sort of suggests that there is something of a third-party nature to consciousness, because otherwise wouldn't you forget your old memories of your grandmother every 7 years? Uh-huh. As far as the role that transhumanism plays, I mean, I think that it's just a natural, progression. I mean, we've really had transhumanism with us ever since the first pirate lost his leg and slapped a peg on it. But I think the important thing to remember as we sort of rush, as we slouch towards the future as we do, that there has to be a suitable reason for doing this stuff. I mean, I still have a flip phone. I just now got an iPod Touch, which I am loving. But, there are so many ways to be plugged in now, and I can – It's almost like there are so many options that you end up throwing up your hands and saying, well, I'll have none of them. And I can see sort of transhumanism going that direction too, if people are basically augmenting their bodies for, just for the heck of it.
Let me stop you right there.
Sure.
Josh, you still got a flip phone? I don't know if you're qualified any longer to even discuss transhumanism.
I know, right?
I mean, people crack on me because I've still got an iPhone 4, man. What is a flip phone? I mean, do you make pancakes with that? Oh, I'm just kidding.
You make buckwheat pancakes and you give them to farmers in Wisconsin.
Exactly. See, he seamlessly ties in a paranormal food reference. Wow. Okay, I'm sorry, Josh. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's all right. But so basically what I'm getting at is that, I don't think I need a heads-up display inside my retina. I mean, I have a pretty good idea of when I need to eat and when I need to go to the bathroom and all these things. It's something that I was given from from the point of conception. I have sensations. Where I do think it would be incredibly beneficial is, if someone has an established medical condition, to be able to monitor that. I think that is really where we will see transhumanism be one of the more applicable and one of the wider uses of this sort of technology.
Well, and I do want to look at some of the pros as well as people's obvious reservations about this kind of a thing. I promise I won't do this all night because he's busy working over there. But Drew, are you there by chance? Have we got you?
Yeah, I'm here.
You are there. Okay, Drew. Now I know you being a guy with a background in tech, frankly, you're one of the most capable IT guys that I know. I'd love to get you to weigh in on this discussion about where we may be going and what our technological future holds for us. Is this a good or a bad thing? And can you see more benefits, I guess, or or more concerns that we should have about this coming transhuman future?
Well, caught me off guard there.
That's what I'm known for, by the way.
You know, I know that we have already, there are already experiments where we have chips implanted in people to help them see and help them hear. And it has been a positive result for that. And I think that with anything, there's a balance to be had there. I think that technology in our world is positive, but if it's used in a good way, but it can also be used bad way. You know, same with nuclear energy. You know, we could use it to wipe out countries, or we could use it to fuel people's homes. So I think that it's a balance there. I do know that the push for data is about connectivity. Right now with your, you know, you look at, we have cars now that have Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
You have a system set up now where I can sync my Firefox with the Firefox on my phone. And we're talking about this connected data where all your devices share the same information. So you can, you know, like you can set your car stuff on your phone. Like you sit down in a car and you adjust the seat and the mirrors and you know, the headlights, and you adjust everything the way you want it. And you can store that in your phone. And in the future, you'll be able to sit down in a car and hit a button, and everything in the car will automatically adjust to your specifications. Your playlist will upload. Everything will be connected. And I think that that's where we're going as far as the technology is concerned, that we're talking about connecting and everything. And look at social networking. It gives us the ability to know what's going on in other countries where governments may suppress information. So I think it can be a good thing. I think integrating technology, I know I've read stories where people talk about, you know, look at the Matrix, you know, they have those plugs in their brains, you know, to jack into a different reality. You have Google Glass, you know, you can stick it on and so you can see, you know, the world in a different way. I don't know. Like I said, it could be good, could be bad. I know that right now we are faced with an issue where it appears that if you're familiar with Moore's Law, it may actually be broken. Huh. And that's going to change the dynamics of technology right there.
I think a lot of things. And he says I caught him off guard. Come on. Drew, are you using like a flip phone or something over there?
No, I used to have one up until about 2 years ago.
Really? Okay. Josh, you're not the only one. Drew, I promise I won't do that all night, but I just thought it was relevant. I knew you'd give some good perspectives on that, and I do appreciate you jumping in there. You know, Red Pill, I'll come back over to you. Something that that Drew had mentioned right there in the point that he made. Has to do with, you know, handing technology over to machines. We're already doing this with self-driving cars. A lot of people are concerned about this kind of a thing. And even apart from the kind of modification of ourselves that we're seeing with the concept of transhumanism, separate from that and apart, I think, from the human modification component is the presentation of intelligence that could be far beyond our own. It may very well change what we know intelligence to be. How will that affect the great question that I think we often discuss, you and I, consciousness? Can consciousness be something that is apart from biological? Or does that kind of come back to what you'd said earlier about consciousness possibly being able to embody some sort of a constructed mechanism like a machine?
Well, I think that's the $64 million question. We just don't know at this point. You know, people at the cutting edge of neurology and even as artificial intelligence, are betting on that, yes, if we can simulate a human brain as faithfully as and accurately as possible, then sure enough, it will become self-conscious. Other people will disagree and say, no, well, consciousness is something much more intrinsicate, much more mysterious than that. And in that way, I go back to this idea like 15, 20 years ago when we were still developing the human genome system. You remember how scientists were telling us that after we finished decoding the whole human DNA, the total number of genes comprising the human genome, then all of a sudden we will enter a golden age of medicine, and they will be able to find cures for cancer, cures for Parkinson's disease, cures for Alzheimer's, because it will be just a matter of finding the gene or genes who were responsible for Alzheimer's and suppressing them or replacing them, you know, and that will be very easy to achieve once we figured out the whole of the genome. But turns out that 15, 20 years after they've managed to do that, we're still waiting for those miracle cures. And the thing is, it turns out those diseases are much more complex than we initially thought of. You know, there's a whole lot of environmental and even now epigenetic things that we didn't take into account. I suspect the same thing could happen with this whole idea of trying to create a very accurate simulation of a human brain. They will manage to do that, and then they will find out that there's something missing, some hidden clue that escaped them. And maybe that hidden clue would force them to realize that this current materialistic paradigm needs to rechange and to be entertain other possibilities, like the possibilities that human consciousness is non-local in nature.
Ah, absolutely. You know what, which reminds me, on this discussion of human consciousness versus maybe another kind of consciousness, I'm going to come to you in a moment, Soraya. I want to take it to Twitter here first for just a moment. Adam Olson, good pal and friend of the program here, writes, I guess people who say futurologist isn't a word don't read Polish-Soviet science fiction. Gosh, it couldn't be a reference to the Strugatsky brothers. Roadside Picnic, I was given a copy of that by Beth Arzee while I was over there in England. Jacob writes, maybe humans are the first intelligent life in space, and it will take millions of years for life to be like what we see in Star Wars. And then Kat, one of our other favorites, a fellow Fadernaut, by the way, also tweets, Clyde Lewis still uses a flip phone. So, Josh, you're not the only one still using a flip phone. Thank you
the
for that.
The Luddite Brigade, I love it.
Yes, that's right. Oh, goodness. Before we go to the break, Soraya, let me come back around to you. This is something I'm sure that you'd be interested in, because you and I both, as podcasters, interview a lot of people about both of these subjects, artificial intelligence and also the quest for alien life. My question to you, which do you think, as we are nearing having the technological fortitude of finding either or, which do you think will come first?
That's an interesting one. I mean, it's a matter of what do you accept as alien life?
That also
because
is a good question.
We may have already found alien life that's not like us, and we just don't know it.
Yeah. Again, this concept I've brought up, Soraya, of life not as we know it. I actually brought that up in the last hour. And again, what do we, in order to be able to discover alien life, do we have to redefine what we call life? Would artificial intelligence apply? I don't think that we would consider something that we helped construct the discovery of alien life. So I think that especially exobiologists and whatnot, or astrobiologists, I should say, I'm sure that they would differ with the AI researchers. But again, if we had to put it in this criteria, let me put it to you like this: if we were going to find evidence of an intelligent alien biological extraterrestrial civilization communicating with us, or if we were going to create artificial intelligence, if it were one of those two, which do you think would be more likely, I would say, in the next century or in the remainder of this one?
I'd say probably artificial intelligence. And I think that because if you're looking at alien life, we have no idea how they communicate. Even if they are similar to us, it doesn't mean they're going to have the same anything that even resembles our technology or ability to communicate with us. Maybe they're already sending us messages like we're sending out to space, but they're just passing each other in such an incompatible way that we don't even know they're there.
Yeah, it's a possibility. And here's another one, too. What you said just now reminded me of something else. If indeed we are trying to communicate with aliens, the singularitarians are always talking about, again, let me go back to the glossary here for a moment so that people understand what we're talking about. Those who are advocates of this coming technological singularity, according to Ray Kurzweil, he uses the term singularitarians. If you don't know about Ray Kurzweil, Google him. But I'm sure he wouldn't mind. But that said, the singularity advocates often say, well, you know, eventually we will head out into space. We will send our technological presence out, and we will populate the universe. We will become one with the universe. I mean, if there is no God, there will be. This according to, and this paraphrasing something that Kurzweil actually says in his book, The Singularity Is Near. And I wonder sometimes, well, if there were an advanced extraterrestrial civilization somewhere out there, and if this concept of a technological singularity is something that is inevitable, when a civilization reaches a certain point of technological advancement, then I should say this. A, would aliens have done the same thing? And B, is that evidence that one of two things has happened, that either we do not have aliens out there who have reached a technological advancement beyond our own, and hence no aliens visiting Earth, or that there are simply no aliens out there at all? I mean, I think that they're both important questions. When we come back from this break, we'll extrapolate a little further on these very interesting varieties of the AI experience, if we want to call them that. Joshua Cutchin, Soraya Azketh, Red Pill Junkie, and I will continue when we return here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. As fury ensues further west, that's right, the Iowa caucus is on, well, on its way to home plate right now. I guess later tonight we're going to hear it the latest. We've been following this over at the Des Moines Register. I'll try and keep people up to date on what's happening out there if and when news arrives, as we always do on this program. But tonight, the subject on the table that we are addressing here present has to do with artificial intelligence, transhumanism, and singularity. Where are we headed? Where are we going? What are we doing? And some people may be still asking, what's he talking about? When actually, I'm just wondering, well, what's he building in there? Yeah. Been trying to figure that one out for ages, it seems like. Our panelists joining us tonight here, Soraya Azketh, Where Did the Road Go?, Joshua Cutchin, and Red Pill Junkie, who has a question which he posited to none other than Uncle Stan. I'm going to have him tell us who Uncle Stan is here in a moment, but I'm going to hint here that already Graylian X subscribers will probably know. And I intend to pick up this conversation, by the way, later this week on Graylian X for subscribers with our panelists as we continue our foray into the unusual. What was it you were talking to Stan about there, Red?
Yeah, well, so, like we all know, this idea of artificial intelligence and transhumanism has permeated all sorts of fields and disciplines in our culture, not just robotics or cybernetics, but also the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And even people like Seth Shostak have wholly embraced the possibility that the first extraterrestrial intelligence we're more likely to encounter will probably be either AI or post-biological in nature. So thinking about you, Micah, and your book, The UFO Singularity, I decided to ask that question to Stanton Friedman back when Tim Binal was announcing his traditional Christmas special, in which he invite Stan and they chat about UFOs and all that. And he also has this question and answer session from his audience. And I ask him, you know, what do you think about Seth Shostak's and others' idea that the first alien intelligence we may find will be some sort of AI? And his answer was that he didn't think so. He dismissed it. And to do that, he cited the famous Bernie and Betty Hill abduction, well, Bernie and Betty Hill abduction case, mm-hmm. in which he said, well, clearly those entities that kidnapped them were humanoid in nature. So therefore, they weren't some kind of robots. And to me, you know, with all due respect to Stan, and I still think he's one of the most important UFO researchers in the field today.
I agree.
I feel that was a, kind of a naive answer because, I mean, it's not like Betty managed to, like, use a knife to cut through the skin of one of those assailants, you know, and to see whether they bled or not. You know, they could have been some kind of androids of some sort, you know, for all we know. It's not just because they looked humanoid doesn't mean that they were biological in nature.
Well, absolutely. See, I this is the problem that I see. And this is what I think, actually. I think that the UFO problem as it is today, one of the big issues, again, respect, though I maintain for Stanton, I completely see your gripe there, and I agree, because I think that, in large part, the UFO community has really kind of become a little too dogmatic. Now, again, I say that the exact same thing has happened among the skeptics just as well. The problem is that whenever a social movement is built around an ideology and the adherents to that social movement all come together professing belief in this ideology, you know, often, although people try to maintain a scientific outlook, at many opportunities, failings can occur. And I see that there's a lot of non-scientific attitudes, both on the belief and even the skeptical side of things. Somewhere there in the middle, I believe, remains probably the closest approximation of truth that a biological entity can hope to try and attain. Or maybe it's not something that we can even hope to attain biologically. Soraya, I know that you had another point to make about the spiritual component about this. I mean, do you think that that's something that we can even understand in our biological meat body brains?
Well, what I was going to say is, I mean, as we move toward ideas of transhumanism and replacing different body parts and things like that, I think some of that stuff is fantastic. I mean, if we could replace things or fix people in ways that make them be able to do everything that everyone else can do, you know, that's great. The problem I see is that there's an idea that this stuff takes us away from our spiritual nature. The more technology we embrace, the less spiritual we become. And maybe the whole point of being here is to understand that spirituality, and this stuff is taking us in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
That's sort of the we have to balance it, I think, is the problem. We live in a world that's very materialistic and very out of touch with that spiritual side of us, and this stuff is only going to make it worse if we don't have some kind of balance going the other way.
Yeah, and I would, to sort of piggyback off that, I mean, I think regardless of anyone's belief system, you know, if you're a Christian like me, or if you're an atheist or somebody who just believes in just, you know, pure chance, the environment, that some sort of force shapes us, and it shapes us to be best suited for our environment. The environment exerts forces on evolution as a process, and to think that we're wiser about what direction we should be taking than that, you know, ancient, presumably universal process, I think is the height of arrogance. The question is, have we changed our environment to the extent that we need to be making these leaps in our own sort of personal evolution on our own? Do we need to intervene to make ourselves fit this environment that we've created for ourselves?
See, this is why I like talking with you guys. Josh, let me, while I got you on there, ask you another question. By the way, thank you for those points, Soraya, because on that subject of spirituality, I certainly agree. And I think, you know, whether you're someone who comes from a Christian background, or a person who is entirely agnostic or even atheist, you know, a person who is of Muslim faith, a person who's Shinto, Buddhist, whatever, you know, I think that, again, spirituality is something that we can all share in common, apart from dogmatism associated often with religious beliefs. And maybe it's something that we all stand equally to lose if we move further and further away from our ability to look within ourselves for certain answers, certain truths, which, again, I think, apart from what we can understand scientifically about the universe, really, we have no hope of understanding within ourselves. And really, I think that we can learn so much about the universe. We can attain so much knowledge. You know, new studies push forever further the boundaries of the human brain and what we're able to store in it. But, you know, at the end of the day, how well do we know ourselves? That, I think, will maintain and will remain, I think, the standard as far as what we are capable of and really where humankind will be able to go and what benefit we'll be able to bring to the world. Now, not just changing gears completely, because this is really related, but I'll start with you here, Josh, on this one. There was a paper that was published in the American Journal of Modern Physics, and again, there's some dispute about the reputability of this paper. The reputation is indeed in question as a result of the questions surrounding the aforementioned journal. But the paper in question is titled Apparent Detection via New Telescopes with Concave Lenses of Otherwise Invisible Terrestrial Entities. Now, Ruggero Maria Santilli has published this of Thunder Energies Corporation in Florida. What he claims is that he has a special kind of a telescope, and I actually think I know how this thing works. And he says that he has found evidence of some kind of an, I want to word this carefully, a presence, some sort of an aerial phenomena, apparently. And he believes that whatever these aerial presences are actually observing certain sensitive locations. Now, of course, many immediately look at this and think that this is absurd. I'm sure that many people who listen to my podcast probably think that this discussion is absurd just as well, but within the broader context of the discussion of UFOs, with very careful and critical outlook, I mean, I had to look at this paper and say, could there be anything more to it? Especially if, whether, you know, no matter how Mr. Santilli perhaps interprets what he says that he has filmed. First, there's the question of, you know, did he film anything? Second is the methodology employed in filming it, which I think is very similar to what we call a Foucault setup with a concave mirror. But, and then the final question is, you know, if he's interpreted correctly and his technological application is indeed, you know, kosher and he has found evidence of something, then how much of what we observe is truly indicative of what the reality is? In other words, what is it that we're seeing? I first would probably say man-made something, drones, some kind of an actual physical presence, but probably something that has a simpler, more prosaic explanation. Now, he seems to suggest with the title of the paper, which I'll read again here, Apparent Detection via New Telescopes with Concave Lenses of Otherwise Invisible Terrestrial Entities. He hasn't ruled out that these terrestrial entities are something maybe that are technological in origin, but he doesn't state that explicitly. But this is an interesting paper, especially for those who are at least open-minded or agnostic toward the UFO question. Josh, I sent this out to everyone earlier. Did you have a chance to look at this?
I did. I probably didn't scour it as in-depth as you did.
Well, don't worry. It's an entertainment program. I will say that.
yeah, I mean, I think there's so much to unpack in it. I mean, barring the idea that this is just a sophisticated version of a flea circus, where the actual device itself or the actual medium itself is producing, you know, the supposed phenomena, I really can't speak to that. But I do think that even if it's not, I mean, the term invisible terrestrial entities is invoked, and the term entity makes it sound like there's some sort of intelligence or consciousness to these anomalies, which I think is just it's a bridge too far for me to jump on to. I mean, I think in order to use that terminology, you'd have to establish that these things can react in some sort of sentient way, and I don't think that really is borne out by the observations that he's made. Having said that, you know, I think it is interesting that there appears to be some sort of anomalous, peculiar behaving phenomena that is going unnoticed, and I think it really does underscore how little we know about the world around us. You know, I always think the fact that in terms of perception, what we have evolved to perceive on this planet may be something very different than another species evolves to be able to detect. In other words, if there's a species on another planet where it's a matter of life and death to avoid pockets of radiation, they may have some sort of organ that can detect that, or even detect things that, you know, we are just now beginning to understand at the quantum level or something. So it's interesting to see that there's, you know, this idea that some sort of sensory apparatus or some sort of artificial sensory apparatus could actually be able to interpret some things that we hadn't even thought of. I think that there's some potential in that to be rewarding, but yeah, it's real preliminary. I'd love to see some other people take a look at his work and try to make heads or tails of it from a completely unbiased perspective, a small s skeptical perspective.
Let me say this too: if there's anything to this to be seen, what we're dealing with is some possible new way of visualizing the environment around us, which may reveal as yet possibly misunderstood or unclassified phenomena, at least as it relates to science. We've got to be very careful in the way that we move forward, and I want to toss this out to anybody who might want to chime in here in a moment, but I will say this. There's this interesting story that Paula Harris used to tell that she said that she spoke to J. Allen Hynek, who told her prior to his death off the record that during a television appearance one night, he was backstage with Carl Sagan, and he said that Carl Sagan said to him candidly, "I know that there are UFOs, whatever they may be. I do know that there are UFOs. The thing is that," he said, "I could not go out publicly being the science educator that I am and advocate that position publicly. I couldn't do that because, I mean, funding, you know, there's so many issues that in academia we face, and therefore," he says, "unfortunately, the expectations that as a serious scientist that I must maintain," I could never publicly say that, but he said privately, and again, this is what Paula Harris said, Hynek said, Sagan told him, "Whatever they are, I do believe that there are UFOs, I just can't talk about it publicly," which is not very different from what in the first hour I talked about with reference to that invisible college. But that said, my feeling in my gut is that probably there are many scientists out there who would be more than willing to try and replicate a study like what Mr. Santilli has claimed he has done with this paper and to try and also visualize these things. Now, question, will anyone do it? I'll open the floor to anybody who'd like to chime in. I mean, about this or any other similar perspective methodology we might employ or employ to trying to find evidence of things in our environment or in our world or in our universe, which we don't see outright, but which may be there.
Well, this makes me think of the different UFOs that have been caught on infrared, as well as some of the orgone experiments where they would draw down orgone energy and be able to take infrared photos of creatures that look very much like this.
Okay.
Yep.
And that's as soon as I saw that, that's exactly what it made me think of. I mean, Andrew Collins wrote a book called Alien Energy, talking about this type of stuff and the different photographs of stuff. They would have two cameras right side by side, one in infrared, one normal, and they would take very distinct pictures of things that weren't showing up in the regular camera. I don't know if I go with the theory that these are giving off some kind of antimatter light necessarily, as much right. as they may just not be in our visual spectrum.
Well, exactly. But don't animals always tend to react differently to the environment than we do? I mean, think about all the stories, whether it be people claiming they've got a haunted house or whatever. As a matter of fact, actually, earlier this hour I mentioned, I've got this beautiful battered copy. I love an old book that's seen a little bit of wear, and I buy a lot of used books on Amazon and stuff, but I've got my, and I think I've got a copy of this already somewhere, but it's back so far back in the dungeons. I've got my house is a library. So I bought a new copy, The UFO Handbook by Alan Hendry. But, you know, there's a whole section in this book about animal response to the apparent stimuli of the presence of an unidentified flying object. Now, the point I'm making is, don't animals often respond differently to things in the environment? Now, could it be that much like an animal is capable of a finer ability to be able to perceive in the darkness, or, you know, again, their infrared visualization capacities are better than that of a human, couldn't it be that there are things in the environment which we just, in terms of our basic senses and how we've evolved to be able to relate to our environment through the senses, that there are limitations and that there are certain things that we and certain science and certain scientific equipment have yet to document?
I would love to jump in right quick, because this is something that I've been giving a lot of thought to lately.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting because it doesn't even need to be something that we aren't aware of for animals to react differently to it. I mean, a lot of research coming out now suggests that the way that animals react to early indicators of earthquakes, or that they're actually reacting to gases that come out of the ground. They're actually detecting that by smelling this. And it's interesting. A cat's sense of smell is 14 times greater than that of a human, and dog noses are 10 to 100,000 times more as acute. And I actually have this quote pulled up because it's from my latest draft of my book. Sensory Research Institute at Florida State University, James Walker is the guy's name. He says, "Let's suppose that they're just 10,000 times better with their sense of smell, dogs that is. If you make the analogy to vision, what you and I can see at a third of a mile, a dog could see at more than 3,000 miles away and still see just as well." So, you know, there are a plethora of things that animals could be reacting to that, you know, without even invoking things that we haven't even discovered in terms of sensory perception.
Well, good points. Red, what do you think about this?
You know, getting back to this whole thing about Santilli, so I tried to read his paper.
Yeah.
There were a lot of red flags that I found, even as a layman. You know, the first thing is that regardless of the credibility or the kind of paper that he used to present this study, the kind of publication he used to present this study. At the end of the paper, the references were all made by himself. So all he did was reference himself in order to explain this supposedly discovery of these invisible entities and whatnot. Also, the fact that he kind of like he said that he presented evidence to the discovery of the existence of antimatter stars, antimatter galaxies, antimatter asteroids. I think that was the whole point to this technology that he created, right? And this, the discovery of these other entities was completely by accident. Now, I tried to make a very, very cursory search into the matter, and as far as I could tell, the idea of antimatter galaxies or antimatter stars is not currently entirely ruled out by modern physics, but it seems almost completely unlikely. Why? Because as far as we can tell, in our observable universe, there is only regular matter that is present, and all the rest of the antimatter, which presumably was created during the Big Bang, was somehow annihilated during this process these guys call baryogenesis, whatever that the hell that means, right? So the thing is that to this point we really don't know if there is such a thing as an antimatter galaxy. Maybe there could be if it's really, really, really far away and it has no way of interacting with regular matter, otherwise it will self-annihilate. So this other idea that he's positing, that, you know, antimatter would have this kind of negative gravity when interacting with regular matter, I don't know if he's mistaken antimatter with what physicists now call dark matter, because there could be no interaction with regular matter. They would instantly self-annihilate and create this massive explosion, the biggest explosion that physicists know of right now, you know, and it will be create a discharge of X-rays. So all those things combined make me really, really suspicious about his claims, not to mention that all those pictures that he posted on this paper, well, those blobs to me are completely, you know, incomprehensible. You know, you could tell me that those blobs, they represent, I don't know, bacteria, you know, taken with a microscope, and I will believe it, because to me, those are blobs. You know, I don't really know what those streaks or images in those blobs are supposed to represent. So, to me, at this point, I really have no way to gauge on this guy's claims, his methodology, and the evidence he's presenting. I will try to remain as open-minded as possible, but right now, color me skeptic.
Let me just interject very briefly here. Peter Voigt, okay, he's a theoretical physicist at Columbia University, and he wrote the book Not Even Wrong, The Failure of String Theory and the Search for Unity in Physical Law and More. Now, he obviously is taking a counterposition to many physicists, but he's also a mathematics professor at Columbia University, and his blog is called Not Even Wrong, sharing the title of his book, and he wrote a blog post about the American Journal of Modern Physics, in which he looked at all of the evidence which he feels is indicative of something rather strange about it. He says, it's possible I just got unlucky, but there was a problem only with the first of the papers I looked at, or that was the case, but this seems unlikely. He said, I realize this is a very obvious case of a journal with extremely low standards run to make money off of the increasingly popular author pays model of financing journals. He's talking about the Journal of American Physics, which is the very journal which published Santilli's paper. He says, I'm hoping that those are just Or rather, he says, yeah, but I'm hoping that those are trying to move high-quality journals to this model, those who are doing this, rather, are seriously thinking through the issues involved. And he goes on basically just to have a few more complaints about this in this blog post. The point is that, again, many people, as I've been able to find, and he's not the only one who's talked about this, there's also an article at scholarlyyoa.com titled Mysterious Publisher Launches with 44 Journals, and they actually comprise the Journal of American Physics and a few others. So and he lists them all in this blog post, but many people prior to the publication of this article have been asking questions about the journal in which it was published, which is an interesting problem unique within science, that when people can't get their ideas published, they just form their own journals, and these journals almost inevitably end up presenting information which is suspect. Good example, Melba Ketchum and the whole Sasquatch DNA thing. Yep. So let's just go ahead and put that out there so that the skeptical, and there are many of them, and God bless you for your skepticism. The skeptic listeners will know this probably already, and I would expect them to point this out. And if you haven't heard about it, well, you heard it here first. Now, that said, guys, closing comments. We've got about 3 minutes. We'll start with you, Soraya.
Oh, as far as this goes, like I said, I'm interested in it because of the connections to the other type stuff that we've seen in the past. As far as the journals and stuff go, a lot of this stuff is not going to get published in primary journals because it's not fitting in the modern paradigm. And that leaves a problem of what do you do with it if you can't get your stuff published simply because it's not an acceptable paradigm.
See, that's a good point right there. And boy, we'll have to probably save that for the Graylian X discussion, because that's actually a brilliant point, and I do want to talk about that. Could certain information be so far out that even if to be justified later by science and found to be feasible, it's beyond the current existing paradigm? Joshua Kochum, we've got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo all of Soraya's sentiments. And I think that it's important, caveat emptor with stuff like this. Take a look at the journal. Take a look at, don't be afraid to do a gut check on stuff like this, and to really, see if it passes the smell test. Let's see if there are any other phrases I can fit in there.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Or we could ask Red Pill for his idea about phrases that we might try and cram into the last 1 minute and 15 seconds.
Oh God. Well, obviously I'm not skeptical. I'm very much open to the idea of other realms, other levels of existence.
But hold on, RP, but yet you brought a brilliantly skeptical analysis of the paper to the table. Mm-hmm. See, that to me is good skepticism, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to those ideas. In fact, I suspect, check that I don't use, try to not use the word believe, I suspect that the UFO phenomenon stems from a reality from which our own reality is only a subset. But at the same time, I feel that we shouldn't take for granted the claims of people like Santilli or of other people just because they use really technical looking or really scientific looking jargon.
Well, absolutely. I think you're right. At my best, what I would hope is that this is a pseudoscientific paper which may have made some observations of a possible reality as yet unproven to science. Look, that's going to have to be the final word. I want to appreciate, or rather, I want to show appreciation for my panelists, Red Pill Junkie, Joshua Kochum, and Soraya Azkath. Thank you guys so much, and we'll continue this discussion for subscribers, but this is going to be it for the final word in this final hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Hey, the Iowa caucuses will be reporting back tonight. Going to be some interesting stuff. We'll have to see what happens. I'm sure we'll have a report on that next week on the program, but here, on behalf of all of us at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, John Anderson, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, Dick Oakley, Race and Robin Hobbs, Drew the Geek, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, as well as our panelists this hour, I bid you adieu, my friends. And as always, until next time, stay strange out there. We'll talk to you again soon.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, graylianreport.com.